On this third Sunday of Advent, Gaudete Sunday, which is Latin for rejoice, and this is when we light the pink candle because that's the color of rejoicing, and the word rejoice comes up over and over again in the readings today. But it's a kind of a conflicting message, or at least seemingly so, because there isn't much to rejoice about. You know, Advent is the season of hope. And as St. Paul says, hope isn't hope unless the situation is hopeless. Hope isn't based on physical evidence. It's based on a deeper sense of God's presence in good times and in bad, you know, through thick and thin. It has those contemplative eyes to see, despite the evidence, that God is present in our lives and that the kingdom is now. So, Zephaniah is telling those people in the darkest hour of their history, the exile, to rejoice. It doesn't make any sense. And yet, in a strange, contemplative way, it does make sense. Joy is contrasted with happiness. Happiness is fleeting, it's momentary. You know, you eat a great dessert and it makes you happy, but a half hour later, that's gone. The calories are still there, but the joy is something deeper and more abiding. Joy recognizes in the long picture of things that God is present. And that's what we survive on. You can't survive on happiness because it's up and down and it's fleeting, but joy endures, and it becomes the basis, the foundation of our lives. And that's the kind of joy that Zephaniah is encouraging them to have, that kind of rejoicing. Now, John the Baptist comes preaching good news, and it's such good news to them that they think that maybe he might be the Messiah, the one who is to come. Joy, for Old Testament people, was largely based on that expectation that the Messiah was coming, that all that was wrong in our world was going to be righted by God, that God was going to come actively with an agent to save us from our sin, to save us from the world's ills, to save us from injustice and oppression and all the things that make life difficult, that God was going to actively save in ways that humans couldn't ever seem to figure out. Because there's always inequality and there's always injustice, but the hope was based on the expectation that God would fix what we can't. So when John comes preaching that salvation is near, they think that he's the Messiah. But he quickly pushes that off and says, no, I'm not the one. There's one coming after me. But here again, we have this conflicting message. John is preaching a baptism of repentance, of metanoia, of turning around, a change of mind. And this is something that's fairly difficult to grasp. And so people say, well, what should we do? And then he gives them this rather practical advice. If you have two cloaks and somebody next to you has none, give him one of them. It's just common sense. But people don't do it. He tells soldiers, don't extort people. Don't falsely accuse people and be satisfied with your wages. I mean, it's just common sense. To tax collectors who were given a certain amount that they had to give to the Roman government, and then whatever they charged over and above that was their commission. And some of them charged a lot more and they got rich. And so John is saying, just curb it back a little. Be reasonable, make what you need for a living, but don't take advantage of people. Just common sense. But it's a common sense that isn't normally practiced in this world. Yes, there are exceptions. There are a lot of generous people in the world. But the world would be a lot better place if people had followed the advice of John the Baptist all through the ages, wouldn't it? But Jesus, when he comes, he's taking it even farther, way farther than John the Baptist. John has a practical kind of repentance wisdom. Jesus is asking us to be God. In the Trinity, there is no self-concern. Nobody is working on a commission for anything. Nobody is worried, has any anxiety about their own self. They are so confident in it that they just give it away. So the three are constantly dying for each other, giving up their security, giving up everything, and then receiving that back from the other two. That's what it means to be divine. And so Jesus says, if someone asks you to go 1 mile, go 2. If someone asks you to give you their cloak, give them your shirt as well. It's this excessive kind of laying down your life, giving up everything, worrying more about the other person's needs than your own. This is what it means to be divine. But this is also what you and I are called to. We are called not to be good human beings. We're called to be divine. We're called to be Christ-like. We're called to be re-headed, to make Christ our head and become his body, so that we think like Jesus and we have a heart of Jesus. That's what changes the world. And you don't get much credit for that. And you don't win in earthly terms. You lose. You get taken advantage of. You get ridiculed. People think you're crazy. Just like Jesus. His own family thought he was crazy. He'd upset people so much by his generosity of spirit that they put up a false accusations of a mock trial, executed him. We live in our faith in an eschatological way. Eschatology is the study of the last things. In other words, to say that we live eschatologically means that we live as if the kingdom were now, as if that future rendezvous between God and all of his creation, and which is going to include you and me, as if that rendezvous were already happening in Manhattan, Kansas in 2019. We're almost there. So that our ethic is not an ethic based on let's get along. It's an ethic based on the kingdom, where everyone will be laying down their lives for each other, where there will be no self-concern and no animosity and no loss and no failure, because everyone will be like the Trinity, giving themselves completely. It takes a little bit of courage to live that now, because the rest of the world isn't on the same game plan. But we are called to do that as closely as we possibly can. And what gives us the courage and the strength to even try that? Right here. Here we remember that Christ did that once and for all, and that he has invited us into a share in that kind of life. And so we gather around here and we remember what's already been done by God on our behalf. We remember that we've already been called, we've already been redeemed, we've been baptized into that. And we look forward to the final resolution of that, the great rendezvous at the end. And then we eat it and we drink it. We take it into our bodies. We become one with it. This is what we call grace. The grace of dining with God in the kingdom. The grace of becoming one with him. And as St. Augustine says, the amazing thing about Eucharist is not so much that he comes in and gets digested and runs through our veins and becomes part of us, as the fact that we become part of him. The real transformation in the Eucharist is not so much God coming into bread and wine and you and me, as we going into him.